Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for January's Nurses Club webinar. I'm delighted to introduce you to our speaker for today, Chartered Animal Physiotherapist Suzanne Cottrell. Thank you, Suzanne. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thanks for that, Emma, and hello, everybody. Welcome to the acute neurology patient and physiotherapy. As Emma says, my name is Suzanne Cottrell, and I'm a chartered veterinary or animal physiotherapist. I qualified as a human physio in 2003 from Salford University and as an animal physio in 2006 at the Royal Veterinary College. For the past 8 years, I've only worked on animals, but I do still treat the odd human, and most humans are very odd as far as I'm concerned, but there we go. I am qualified to treat all animals, but mainly treat horses, dogs and cats. And although I have my own practice, I don't take on any new clients now, as I actually work full time at the University of Liverpool. Half my time I work in clinic, and the other half I actually run the Masters in Veterinary Physiotherapy. I am a member of the Chartered Society of Physiotherapy and a Category A member of the Association of Chartered Physiotherapists in Animal Therapy. So that's what all those bits and pieces after my name actually mean. Today then, the main focus of this session is to present acute neurology problems in the small animal and looking at the physiotherapy you can start with whilst in hospital. I'm going to look at two key conditions with you, their presentation and prognosis, and three key physiotherapy techniques that we can carry out on them whilst in hospital. As you know, physiotherapy always works closely with medication or rest as well as surgical interventions to maximise any form of treatment. And the communication between the physio and the vet is obvious, but the importance of an MDT approach will become more apparent as I explain the physio that we use. At the end of this session, you should have a good understanding of what range of motion means and be able to practice some basic massage and sensory work on a small animal in the acute stage. The most common neurology problems that you come across within hospital tend to be the intervertebral disc disease or fibrocartilaginous embolism. So I'm going to concentrate on those two main problems, their presentation and prognosis, as well as how they're treated. You'll see that many of the problems require similar types of physiotherapy, but the focus and order of treatments will be different. For example, with intervertebral disc disease and fibrocartilaginous embolism, we tend to concentrate more on correcting the gait pattern, how the animal is actually walking, whereas with something like CDRM, degenerative myelopathy, we concentrate mainly on strengthening. All the treatment tools you see being used are suggested methods from various sources. The true animal research evidence is a little thin still, but a number of authors recommend these types of treatments for these types of conditions. So if you're looking to actually support what you're doing with the vets within your practice or the owners, then there are a couple of books that actually do this. So Mills, Levine and Taylor, they do offer formal protocols for the neurologic patient, as do McGowan, Goff and Stubbs. The 2010 edition of the BSAVA Manual of Canine and Feline Rehabilitation, Supportive and Palliative Care, a mouthful. This also has three chapters dedicated to physiotherapy in small animals and its application in a number of disorders, including neurological, which is good. These are case study based, but they do at least provide us with some guidelines on what, how and how often the rehabilitation should occur, and outcomes that have actually been proven to improve with physio treatments. So what you're doing is worthwhile, definitely. There are, of course, lots of other neurological problems that you will come across when you're in a referral centre and also in first animal practice. These are on neurology problems are less prevalent than IVDD and FCE, and the nature of these problems will determine the type and regularity of any physio you would do. But the basics of range of motion, massage and sensory work can apply to most pathologies that you see in this list here. As with any treatment, of course, the vet will direct and authorise your physiotherapy, and they, of course, will be aware of any contraindications. So if we have a dog with tetanus, which actually isn't on that list, then you're not going to go in and do aggressive physiotherapy, as you are going to actually make that dog worse. Let's look at interstitial disc disease in quite a bit more detail then. Okay, so as you're probably aware, it can occur at any spinal level, but it's mainly seen in the cervical or thoracolumbar areas, so the neck or the lower back areas. It can, of course, affect all the hind limbs, it can affect all limbs, which is paraparesis. It can affect the hind limbs, which is paraparesis. It can affect all four limbs, which is tetraparesis, or it can affect ipsilateral limbs on one side of the body only, which is hemiparesis. Muscle tone can be flaccid or spastic, and can change during the rehab process. The prognosis is going to be good if surgery is performed at the right time for grade 3 to 4 problems, for example, but conservative management of the problem is possible if grade 1 or 2 and is caught in the early stages. Once the pain is controlled in the dog, you can start physio, normally within 24 hours of surgery, and this is normally in the form of passive range of motion, skin sensitization and massage to reduce or increase tone as needed. As I said, the tone can be very low or very high. Just to give you an understanding briefly of the grades, grade 1 is painful, the dog is painful but has no neurological deficits, right through to grade 5 where they have loss of all motor and sensory function. So a grade 2, paresis can be mild to moderate and they may have spinal pain as well. And grade 3, they can have severe paraparesis and be non-ambulatory. And you can improve a dog with conservative management at that grade. What do we actually do then? Okay. We do for supported and facilitated work to start with, to start the sit and stand positions. So the dog is actually recumbent very often. But the normal position for a dog is to sit or to stand as well as to lie down. And once we're in those facilitated or supported positions, we then do rhythmic stabilizations to initiate some muscle activity. All this I'm going to show you in videos later on, so don't get too hung up on the words at the moment. I also would do sensory work on the paws to start the withdrawal reflex and limb protraction or retraction, so moving the legs forward or back. In a reflex method. So we reassess the dog every time that they're seen, and this can be 2 to 4 times a day during hospitalisation, and therapy obviously has to be changed accordingly. Progression is the key, and the speed of progression will vary depending on the severity of the spinal cord compression, but the earlier the dog is diagnosed and care started, the better the prognosis, and that is scientifically proven now. Most dogs will start to stifle walk within 5 days, and they usually go home with harness and sling walking support pretty quickly. This is clearly more difficult with the larger dogs due to weight, and other things must be considered. So the owner's ability, can they actually manage a dog? Do they have their own problems in terms of balance and stability? The dog's personality, are they happy to actually be managed in this way, or are they demotivated? What the home environment is like, do they have wooden floors or have they got carpet, and what the finances are like as well. So there's lots of things to consider, unfortunately. The gait re-education includes facilitated walking on dry land and in the water treadmill, if that's available, plus lots of core stability improvement. And all work should be done slowly to ensure the dog actually does weight bear on the affected legs and gives the muscle memory time to reactivate and the nerves to regrow. But the key to physiotherapy that you're doing is the fact that the trained physiotherapist can identify what and when to progress to maximise rehabilitation. And that's something that you need to do when you're in hospital, keep reassessing all the time. And alongside all of this work, the physiotherapist will continue to use manual therapy and provide a progressive home exercise program as an outpatient. And the dog could be under the physio for up to 6 months, but obviously won't be in hospital for that length of time. So I'm looking at the acute stage of physiotherapy in a little bit more detail. So I've talked about this passive range of motion, stimulation, relaxation, massage, and sensory work. And all of this is a good start, especially for the recumbent dog. The other three techniques there, the rhythmic stabilization, supported standing, and supported or facilitated postural sets, can also be used within the first few days of treatment within the acute phase. But the amount of and timing of these will depend on the severity of the problem. So that's why I'm just looking at the first three of range of motion, massage, and sensory work. I'm going to look at passive range of motion in the next two slides in a little bit more detail so you can understand a little bit more depth how it actually works and identify when it's not appropriate, because that is just as important as when it is appropriate. Okay, so don't worry too much about this slide. I'm going to go through it in some detail. It looks more complicated than it actually is. So we talk in physiotherapy about physiological and accessory joint motion. So if I just pick up my marker there. So joint motion movement can be split between active and passive, okay? And then active joint motion can be split between free active motion, so the dog doing it themselves, active assisted, and resisted, okay? And they're all what they say on the tin. A resisted movement can be further stationary, isotonic, or moving, isokinetic. And all these have their role in joint mobilization and muscle development. So if I go back to free active motion, this tends to be gross movements, often without going to end of range, where there can be a painful or bony end feel. So a gross movement basically is like sit to stand. If I then look at active assisted movement, this can increase the range but must stay within in the anatomical range of motion to remain therapeutic and not become adverse or painful. Resisted motion tends to be used to develop muscle bulk, but is often in a range because of this. If we go to end of range on a resisted movement, this is normally on fitter animals and is there to improve existing good activity. So if you're gym people, you like to go to the gym, you're going to be doing all of these movements. Your free active movement, lifting the weights. Your active assisted, lifting the weights with the help of a pulley. And then you're resisted, lifting the weights against some using a TheraBand, and you could hold the weight up for a period of time or move that weight. So a physiological movement is one in which the animal can actually perform it for themselves. It's voluntary and it can occur either actively or passively. So, for example, an active physiological movement is their dog sitting down on command. A passive physiological movement is the dog sitting down with your hands on the dog and facilitating that movement. So movements such as flexion, extension, abduction, adduction, rotation, gliding, sliding, these are all physiological movements. Okay. And if you think of the dog sitting down, going from sit to stand, or stand to sit, then the hips obviously flex. Sometimes the hind legs will abduct, or the stifles, the knees fall out. A passive physiological movement is actually performed by the therapist at slow speed. So this is what we're talking about in your passive range of motion. The technique can be applied in an oscillatory way or a sustained stretch, so a moving or actually holding the position for a long period of time. And the idea is that this movement decreases pain or increases mobility. And this movement, as I said before, is gross, so it's a big movement in a wide range of motion. And ideally, the animal should be relaxed, so the muscles allow the joint to achieve their full range of movement, and it should be a pain-free range. So we're talking about these passive movements in the anatomical range. If I then move to passive accessory movements, these are things that you probably won't do as a vet nurse within the acute environment. But just to give you an idea of what they actually mean, What these are joint surface movements that can occur in when a bone movement takes place. So they're passive movements that include slides or glides, rolls or spins, distractions, tractions, compressions, that sort of thing. And what happens is, for example, when the femoral condyle rolls on the tibial plateau, that allows the joint to move fully. So they're not movements that you would particularly need to do as a passive range of motion. They're actually a little bit beyond what the animal would do normally within a gross or physiological movement. So they're not something that you need to actually be able to do, but they're something that you need to be aware of when you're doing your passive range of motion. So basically, you're not going to go beyond your passive range of motion into your accessory movement, because this can be painful. And it may be that the animal at that stage is not appropriate for them to actually do that. You may, because they could be particularly flaccid, so you're going to take the joint into a movement that's the muscle can't support, or they may have arthritic changes in other joints which are sore, and they haven't actually moved them for a while because they've been on cage rest. So you're going to take those arthritic joints into a painful area as well. So just to be aware of those different manual therapies and passive range of motion. You will hear physios talking about graded movements and graded passive range of motion. And this just gives you an idea of what that actually means. So it can go from 1 through to 5, whereas 1 is a small movement and grade 5 is a manipulation. So grade 1s to 4 are things that you will do for your passive range of motion, but grade 5 would be a manipulation, and you wouldn't actually go into that that movement. It can be painful, okay? It's rarely used by animal physiotherapists because it's performed at the pathological limit of the joint and is intended to alter positional relationships. So if I do it on humans, I may crack the back, and you may have come across that on your thoracic spine, but it tends not to be used with animals. So because of all these different types of movement that can be done, it's essential that you actually evaluate the joint before you even do your passive anatomical range of motion to ensure that any underlying problems are recognized, such as a very lax joint or an arthritic joint. So an animal could have an arthritic elbow and be on cage rest post-hemilaminectomy, and then this elbow could be acutely painful to reduced activity, lack of appropriate medication, sometimes they have to be taken off their non-steroidals temporarily, and recumbency. So the passive range of movement performed on this joint will be different to that on other joints that are more lax. So that's the science looked at. Let's look at the video in a little bit more detail. So if I then go to looking at your passive range of motion, you can see me working here on a nice recumbent dog, okay? And note the slow speed of the passive range of motion and the fact that I'm working in the sagittal plane, or keeping the leg close to the body. Okay, so I'm not bringing the leg out or in, I'm not aboradducting, I'm keeping it in line with how the joints actually work. So it's like a cycling motion, okay, to ensure a positive therapeutic effect. And it's the start of the exercise that can be actually developed into active assisted or active range of motion when the physiological effects are greater. And you see me working in a range there, and I'm cycling backwards and I'm cycling forwards. Exercise is known to release serotonin, which is a mood enhancing hormone, which obviously makes the animal feel better. So the idea of the passive range of motion is that this actually starts those serotonin hormones being released. So you actually feel better once you go to the gym, even if you don't want to. And this can be, this passive range of movement can be quite nice for the animal because you're close to the animal, you've done massage as well, or we will be doing massage as well. So everything feels good, basically. So note, nice and slow, trying to keep the animal nice and relaxed, and moving the limb through its range of motion. So it's a gross range of motion, and beginning to actually allow the animal to think about moving those joints in the direction of walking. So let that one finish. Lovely. Okay, so let's go on to massage then. I don't know how many of you have had massage yourself, but it can be really, really relaxing. Or if you're going for a sports massage, it can be quite painful. But massage is a key skill for the physiotherapist. And because of this, it's a very in-depth topic and can be complicated. It has a lot of underlying physiology to support it. But briefly, the key benefits to massage are increase of blood flow and improvement of lymphatic drainage, which introduces nutrients to the area and obviously removes toxins. It's also known to produce endorphins, more feel-good hormones, and which also relieve pain. We obviously don't have time to go into all of this now, but the video, as the video plays, I'll explain what's being done and how it should be done. Massage for relaxation is about rhythm, continuous touch, and molding the hands to the shape of the animal. So you can see my hands there molding to the shape over the back, and then I'm using the length of my thumb there and the palm of my hand, but not my fingertips, to do the smaller muscles on the proximal limb. So you can see working through the triceps there with the length of my thumb. So although this is a very small dog, you can use the flatter part of your hand rather than the fingertips, obviously, which is much nicer for the animal. So this basic massage technique is called effleurage and can be used to bond with the animal, warm the muscles and gain trust. Larger muscles are best to massage. Just run that again while I'm talking. Neck, hind limbs and back. And aim to do it in a quiet room with minimal disturbances and use it to connect your different treatments. In other words, your passive range of motion and your sensory work, because it can calm the animal down. As you saw there, he got a little bit excited to start with. Tail wag, probably something went on in the room. And now things are a little bit more relaxed. And he's looking at me and I just gently push his head down and tell him to relax again. And a lot of clients now, when they want their dog to relax, they actually start use the word chill and use it as a command. And that works actually quite well. For the relaxation massage, work in the direction of the hair and ensure you use both, but I'm sure both you and the animal are comfortably positioned, as you may massage for 3 or 4 minutes at a time. So I think you've seen that 1.5 times now. So let's move to the next video, which is actually more stimulation massage. Okay, so you can see the difference. It's a lot faster. It actually works against the hair direction as well. And I'm using my fingertips an awful lot more to wake up the general muscle tone. So if you have hind limb tone on a which is low on a hemilaminectomy dog, a post-operative dog, you would work with that stimulation massage around the hind limbs and to the caudal part of the trunk, the back part of the trunk and the back. And then because the front legs could be overused and higher tone, you would change that and do front leg relaxation massage. So use different types of massage and different parts of the dog. Obviously still work in a safe environment and remove everything that's out of the way so that the dog is relaxed enough. Okay, so if we move on to sensory work in the dog. This is an actual video, so apologies for the TV in the background here. But this dog has got spinal stenosis, so it's actually got arthritis in its spine, so the messages through to that right hind leg are much reduced. So as you can see there, I'm working against the fur. I'm working up with my fingertips and a little bit of nail work, so pressing further into the dog, trying to get her to lie down a little bit or to stop looking at me. And then I'm doing that withdrawal reflex work. So I'm taking the leg into retraction. So imagining she's standing, step standing there, and then I'm taking it to protraction. And when it's in that extended or flex position, I'm then giving a gentle squeeze to the web space, and she's bringing the leg forward or back or up. So what I'm trying to emulate there is the movement of walking, okay? And then just another little bit of tail scratching, bottom scratching there, gluteal scratching, hamstring scratching, just waking up all those senses through her hind leg so that she is much more aware of what's going on behind. So the next video will show us the same sort of sensory work, but actually on a cat. I thought I'd show a cat so that you can actually see that we can actually work with cats as well. Most of the cats that I have worked with have been really compliant, like this little chappie here. And you can see here the owner has been taught to do that extension and then reflex withdrawal. So pulling the leg forward or back, pinching the paw web space, and then the animal pulls the leg back. So she's done a couple on the front legs and then doing it on the back leg as well. And although the cat is a little bit tail waggy and not very pleased about it, he's actually dealing with it very well. And then after she's done the sensory work, she'll then try and get him into a sitting position so that he's a little bit more awake. Didn't last very long, but there we go. So I'm just going to run through that again. So a nice, quiet, relaxed atmosphere. Cat knows what's going on. She's pulling the leg forward, pinching the paw, and then the cat does a withdrawal. And then the same with the hind leg, pulling the leg forward, pinching the paw, and he withdraws. Pulling the leg down, and hopefully he withdraws. Not a lot going on, so you need to actually take the limb into flexion or extension, so the limb's got, so the muscles can actually contract. And then trying a standing, and then he's going into sitting. And this is quite nice because this cat couldn't do anything at all about 3 weeks before this was taken. With cats, it's likely that you only actually get 3 to 4 minutes at a time in terms of physiotherapy, but they are normally quite compliant. I talked about rhythmic stabilizations before. I'm going to show you what that actually means, having looked at the three key areas for you for physiotherapy. So, rhythmic stabilizations. Ideally, you want your animal to be able to stand at this point. Okay, so you may do supported standing still. So hind legs there, this is actually a CDRM dog, so he's got very weak hind legs. Very noisy dog, so that's why I've got the video muted at this stage. But basically what I'm trying to do is get the dog into square standing, support or facilitate the hind legs or the paretic limbs as needed. And as you can see, I'm just rocking the animal side to side. I've got my knees against his back legs there and my hands against his shoulders, and I'm just rocking him side to side. And the idea of this is that it starts the muscle getting used to a rhythmic movement, so a continuous rhythmic movement. So at the moment I'm just showing you for 3 or 4 rocks side to side, but what you would aim to do is actually count up to 60. So you're doing 60 seconds, 1 minute of rocking side to side, and the more you repeat it, the more the muscle gets used to the idea of it, and it rocks side to side and turns on, turns off, turns on, turns off. As you can see, he's very noisy. And this is one where I've actually increased the difficulty by putting one of the limbs onto a soft surface as well. So that would be a progression of this exercise. But you can do that rhythmic stabilisation with dogs, and I've done it with cats as well. So if we look at the next video, which is postural sets. What's a postural set, you say? Well, a postural set is actually a sit, a stand, a lie. So any position that the dog normally functionally would like to work in. What we're looking for with our neurological dogs is quality of that postural set. So making the sit square, making the lie square, and making the movement from the sit and the lie into the stand using the correct muscles. So as you can see here, this dog is very weak behind. So his lie and his sit are not square. Because he's got his legs out to one side, when I ask him to stand, he's overusing his front end. And he's not able to use the hind legs as well as he should do. A little bit of sideways there. So you can see he's trying to push his leg forward, but because his right hind is actually across his body, he can't use it correctly. So what I would aim to do is getting him to a square sit. So that's why I brought him round. And then trying from that square sit to get him to stand. But he is very weak behind on that right leg, so that would have to be practiced quite a lot. But you're looking for quality. You're looking for a square sit and a square lie, and then they will push into standing correctly. Looking at the next video, we have one of a cat walking. Again, this is a neurological cat. And I wanted to show you this for the facilitated walking. So this one, first of all, is he's on his own. He's not doing so well. As you can see, he's got a harness on, and cats can get used to harnesses quite nicely. Just show you that again. And that can be really useful for harness and sling walking, even in cats. Initially, when you put a harness on a cat, they tend to just stop moving, but once they've got used to the feel of it, they're okay. So as you can see, this cat is not doing so well. I'll just show you one more time. It's only a few steps there. So we started him off and he goes, nope, can't do it. Left hind sliding underneath and I'll give up. Back end's not moving very well at all. The next video then shows you the same cat and doing facilitated walking. So you can see where my hands are. And you see the difference in the walking. So this is obviously the same day. Show you that again. I'm going to stop it at one point. So I've got there fingertip touch. You can see I've really only got my middle finger and my first finger, but my thumb and my little fingers are away. I haven't got my palms of the hands, so I'm facilitating rather than supporting. So when you look at this cat, it can actually support its hind legs, stand on its hind legs quite well, but its lateral stability is very poor. So if we run it again. So you can see he wobbles. He's very ataxic, isn't he? But you can see his paw placement is really good. So proprioceptively, he's placing his paws, so he's not knuckling or anything like that, so he knows what's going on, but he just hasn't got the wherewithal to be able to support himself laterally, and that's why he was falling. So a really interesting gait pattern there, a real ataxic gait, but you can see the difference, a massive difference with just that little bit of facilitation as he's walking, and we're setting him up to succeed, and because he's walking like that, then he can actually strengthen his muscles. So if you put a harness and a sling on that animal, on that cat, then you would be able to facilitate that walking with a sling, and therefore he would improve quite nicely. So it's great to see a cat doing it as well. Progressing on, then we would destabilize the animal once he's learnt to stand a bit better. So this is a few weeks later. And you can see he's now able to stand pretty much independently and he will be fine on a firm surface. So now I've increased the difficulty for him and put him on a soft surface. And obviously you can do this with dogs. I showed you in the rhythmic stabilizations. So firm surface onto soft surface, wobbling the surface around a bit. So increasing the difficulty, increasing the difficulty for the animal and making the muscles work that much harder. So I'll just run through that again. And again, with cats, he's wanting to get off, but with a little bit of persuasion, he's able to stay on it. And he's really, really compliant and doing really well, looking around at me, wondering what the heck's going on, but able to maintain that standing position, albeit crouched, really quite nicely. And then if you watch him when he comes off, he actually walks quite nicely off the wobble cushion. So if we just hang on and off he comes, and now he's able to take a couple of steps and before he, and it actually turns around without collapsing, which is really good. So the point of these things is that you could do massage on a soft surface, you could do passive range of motion on a soft surface, and progress your exercises even on the acute patient. And a lot of them do like the soft surfaces because they find them quite relaxing. I mentioned as well about going working with water on a hydrotherapy, and I talked about for the intervertebral disc disease and for the FCEs gait patterning. So this, as you can see, this dog's had a hemilaminectomy, and what I'm doing is actually facilitating that walking motion. So what this dog wants to do is to actually hop off the right hind, which is the good leg, hop off the left hind onto the right hind too quickly. So what I'm doing is I've got hold of that right hind, and I'm just trying to slow the movement pattern down so it becomes correctly symmetrical. So you see he's just trying to hop off that right hind all the time, so I'm trying to keep him nice and symmetrical. So I've got full facilitation, got my hand on the right hind on the distal part of the limb, and then on the left hind I'm actually supporting him higher up the limb just so he stays a little bit longer weight bearing on that left hind. So you can see an awful lot of work can be done to correct that gait pattern. So I'm getting him to walk correctly, because what he's trying to do all the time is just to compensate. And dogs will do that, obviously, because they want to just get from A to B as quickly as possible. And they're not thinking about, actually, you know, I've had a hemilaminectomy, I've got to learn to walk again in order to get myself strong on that weaker side. So it's quite hard work. Lot of leaning down, but it does improve them more quickly. They don't have to have water treadmill, but it does improve them more quickly in terms of their gait patterning and their strength, definitely. Moving on then, there are dogs who have intervertebral disc disease in the neck. And what tends to happen with the cervical spine disc disease, who have had a dorsal laminectomy, and are tetraparetic, in other words, nothing's moving, I tend then to swim them. Because they panic so much in the water treadmill, and it's difficult to support the front and the back end at the same time, especially if there's only one of you, I tend then to put them in a pool, go in with them, and take all buoyancy support off them, as you can see with this dog. So this is a Doberman that's had cervical spine surgery. And this is about, it was about 6 weeks before she started doing anything. And that was even in the water. So we had to put her in the water to obviously give her the buoyancy and to make her feel as if she could move her legs and to for us to be able to facilitate the legs. So we started with two people in the water facilitating the front and the hind legs. And this is a few weeks, it's about 6 weeks later, where she actually started moving all four limbs. But really quite hard work for her, as you can see. I'm going to run that again for you. No buoyancy support, as you can see. Not overly keen, really having to work hard to hold her neck up. So we can't start swimming too early because we want to all that surgical inflammation to settle down. But as you can see, moving the front legs, moving the hind legs. And what we're looking for here is the front legs to move symmetrically, which they are there, and the hind legs to move symmetrically, which they are. They're not moving together though, front and back. And as you can see, it's quite on and off. What's happening when she's moving is that she's more motivated. She's heading towards mum, who's moving around the pool and calling her and encouraging her to swim towards her. And we're running this for around about a minute at a time, as you can see. So she would have plenty of rest, but was doing about 4 or 5 minutes in total during these sessions. So a lot of hard work, and she was hoisted in and out of the pool as well because she was quite a big dog. So if we want to see this animal, did she walk again, is what you're asking me, I'm sure, or you're asking yourselves. So I just thought I'd show you the video. This was about 3 months later, and as you can see, she's struggling to get up, but did she walk or didn't she? Just wait for it. She's obviously much more active, head movements, neck movements, absolutely fine. Forelimb movement, really good. She's looking around, she's trying to push up, can't quite get herself into standing independently. But once she's placed in standing, we've actually got a sit now, so we've actually got proprioception and strength in the front legs, so we can sit for a few seconds, definitely. But as you can see, it's very hard work for her. Her effort of work is massive compared to a normal dog. So Dad's going to pick her up again. On the grass, she's a little bit lazy, so she needs a bit more facilitation. But if we put her on a sharper or more abrasive surface, her sensation actually increases quite considerably. And if you now look at her, she gives it a shot and says, yeah, I can have a go at this. Don't like this surface very much. Give me a bit more feedback. I can have a walk. So we're really pleased to say that this dog actually did develop a decent quality of life, and she actually could walk, but it took about 6 months to get her to this position. And as you can see, she's tired quite quickly, but it was a success story, that one, definitely. So that was your intervertebral disc disease, and lots of physiotherapy there. So I'm briefly going to look at fibrocartilaginous embolism. And these can be very simple to treat with minimally affected lymphoresis, or at the other extreme, they can be a longer term issue with marked ataxia, and sometimes they don't return to normal gait and activities. It does often affect active dogs such as agility or flyball, and these dogs do not return to their previous levels of work or competition, and returning to this type of activity can be detrimental, unfortunately. As you may know, the prognosis is normally good, normally resolves within 6 weeks, and as I said, the resolution depends on the severity. Rest is needed, as well as physiotherapy, to ensure a steady buildup of activity is achieved, as too much too soon can cause further damage because the clot hasn't resolved. Other compensatory muscle work can develop if the exercise is not controlled, and secondary muscle injury can also occur. So the sorts of things that, again, we're looking at are your passive range of motion, your sensory work and your massage, and then longer term, definitely strengthening exercises, proprioception and hydrotherapy. Going on to a video for this. This was a 6-year-old dog who had right-sided hemiparesis, she is a collie dog, mad as a hatter, so we struggled. She was a young dog when this happened as well, and an agility dog. It didn't actually happen when she was doing agility, or flyball, sorry. It actually happened when she was just out playing and running. And yeah, mad as a hatter, this dog. So we had to try and find exercises and games that she would actually enjoy, to get her to do three-legged work, to get her to do sensory work, to get her to do sideways, turns, circles, that sort of stuff. And she used to love playing with water. So what we got her to do was actually play with the water. And of course, that's her right fore as well, balancing on the three legs. And that was a great game for her to play with. So what you have to think about is different things that the owner can deal with, that the dog can deal with, that suits the lifestyle. All those sorts of environmental factors have to be considered when you're looking at longer term physiotherapy. And also even with basic things like passive range of motion. You know, if the dog is of a certain size and can only be worked on the floor, and the owner can't actually get down on the floor for any length of time, then you're going to have to find different ways of working that passive range of motion. I'm pleased to say as well that this dog has done really well. She is not encouraged to jump at all, but now she just has a right floor limp and a bit of right shoulder muscle atrophy. But we've been working on these problems, and she was given specific exercises that were adapted to be fun, as you can see from the video. And she actually went back to a little bit of agility and a little bit of fly ball as well, and is a happy dog, which is good to see. I mentioned to you at the beginning about the multidisciplinary team approach, and it is essential in the field of physiotherapy that more than just physio is involved, and the same in nursing. In human physio, the patient is at the centre of care and needs to buy into the process for it to work. And equally in animal physio, the dog is the case and is at the centre of care, and all aspects of the therapy must be considered for it to be successful. The vet obviously has to diagnose and share the information fully so other professionals involved can give the owner the same message regarding prognosis, speed of recovery and likelihood of re-injury. We know as nurses and physios, if we do discharges, the owner has lots and lots of questions, so we need to make sure that we're saying the same thing as they've heard from the vet. The owner's got to be on board with the program, as they usually be involved on a daily basis with the exercise, but the physiotherapist, we have to take into account the owner's age, abilities, time availability and financial resources when putting a therapy program together. And this process is going to allow the animal to improve as much as it can and enables the owner to come to terms with the change in their dog's abilities. Again, in hospital, as vet nurses, in first opinion practice, we know we're used to seeing animals in this situation. This owner has never seen their dog or their cat or their small animal as a disabled animal, so it's a lot for them to take on. And this is especially true of neurological problems, as the dog is normally left with some gait abnormality, and in the case of CDRM, for example, we know the dog will eventually be euthanized, and they may well be receiving physiotherapy until the week before it happens. As professionals in the veterinary field, we must never lose sight of the fact that the owner is dealing with their first and hopefully only disabled dog, but not everyone can come to terms with this. The evidence for physiotherapy for neurological cases is there, but it's not verified for specific problems necessarily. My aim is to use what works and ideally put in research parameters to validate this when and where possible. So always looking for research opportunities to say, yes, this passive range of movement does work, this massage does work. Anecdotal evidence obviously continues to be highlighted by dog owners, but we need to actually get firmer evidence on this. And this is where the work that you do as nurses within the small animal hospitals and the acute patients is really, really important. And I enjoy working with yourselves and the other multidisciplinary team members. In conclusion then, I've gone over the fact that the acute patient needs to receive physiotherapy in a pain-free range. Okay, you're doing a passive range of motion, make sure it is pain-free. Consider the different types of problems, not just the neurological, but that animal may have osteoarthritic problems as well. Basic exercises can provide huge physiological and psychological benefits in the right hands. So doing them properly helps with making the animal feel good and getting muscles and nerves to work. Working with passive range of motion, massage and sensory therapy on the acute neurological inpatient will enhance speed and quality of recovery, and that is proven, which is good news. But continual reassessment is needed to ensure the right therapy is applied at the right time and to maximise the recovery and rehabilitation. These animals will get better without it, but they won't get better as quickly, and their long-term welfare, their quality of life will not be as good. Remember, even the basic exercises can be dangerous in the wrong hands. If you have any questions, please do email me. I look forward to hearing from anyone, and thank you very much for listening.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Suzanne for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.